So the purpose of today's lecture is really in relation to a lot of these debates and issues and popularity of what we mean by global and sustainable in education. And I know this is very timely with everything that's been going on actually in Scotland in the past few weeks. But also, as we know, it isn't just these discussions have not been relevant for just the past few weeks in terms of how we think about sustainability in the world and within education. These discussions have been going on for quite an amount of time now. What I want us to think about today is really when we start to approach these issues to do with global, intercultural, sustainable, what do we really mean by them? Who are they really for? Who has constructed these particular ideas and discourses? And what particular purpose are they intended for? What are the implications? So what I'm going to go through today is the structure of what we mean by global and intercultural competences first. And I'm going to give you some examples of some of the models to think about intercultural competences, and with specific reference, for example, to the OECD's work. And then I'm going to talk about some of the criticisms of some of these models and some of the problems that will that can have for research, for teaching, and for practice. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about intercultural competences for teachers and what that means for us as teachers in universities, what it means for teachers in schools, and how we can start to do something or think about these issues in relation to our context. Then finally, I'd like to wrap up the discussion and conclusion towards thinking about how do we move towards a global and sustainable intercultural co-competences. So for me, actually, it's shifting away from competences towards co-competences. And this will be something which comes clearer during the lecture. So to start, what do we mean by all this phenomenon? How is it relevant to Finland? How is it relevant to the UK? How is it relevant to global education? So firstly, when we start to think about this in terms of research, when one teaches intercultural communication at a broader level, not just thinking about the competences, the skills and values and everything else that goes along with it, but if we take a step back for a minute and think about what intercultural communication means, one needs to be aware of what we might call the smorgasbord of perspectives on interculturality. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means that this is a mismatch of different discourses, of different practices, of different ideologies that perhaps have been filtered down from policy, from political structures, from guidance frameworks, from our teaching materials, our resources, from our curricula, from our societal discourses in the media, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a bit of a mismatch of all these different things, like when you go to a buffet and you've got hundreds of different dishes to pick from. When I was writing this lecture and thinking about my own research and thinking about my own positioning, I'd like to introduce you to what we call Eurocentric culturalism, differentialism, and renewed interculturality perspectives. These perspectives and the gaps between them have grown radically over the past few decades, and they differ in the way we think about intercultural competences, and especially when we think about how the ideologies have been developed by learners and how they fluctuate between these different positions. And I'll come on to talk a little bit more about what I mean by this. Some of the popular models can be viewed as being derived specifically from Eurocentric culturalist models about intercultural communication, whereby national culture is used as an exclusive way of understanding what people, when people meet each other, that is what this phenomenon is understood by. Other factors tend to be ignored, and such perspectives also tend to create a form of border between us and them, emphasizing on difference over similarity, and we using these categories and labels based upon people's national, ethnic, religious identities, rather than looking at this from an intersectional point of view in issues to do with gender, social class, perhaps language, and other issues which matter also in interculturality. So when we would start to unpack this within the research field, there are three main, what we might call, problematics. The first aspect relates to what we might call a differentialist bias or an obsession were what makes us different from others, rather than considering this perspective from a continuum of differences and commonalities. In a recent book that I published with Fred Durbin, I argued in the book that if we only look for difference in any form of global or intercultural encounters, then difference is all we will look for. It will all that we will see. It will only be the frame of reference and lens that we can see these phenomena through. We therefore have to think about, okay, maybe we are all different as human beings, but we might also share some commonalities and share some interests together in these aspects too, which need to be taken into consideration. The second aspect, as hinted before, is this over-reliance on culture as a single analytical category and sole marker. And this is something which for me is deeply problematic when you say, oh yeah, but it's because of their culture or this culture or my culture. But what culture are we really talking about? You know, culture is very polysemic. It's very unstable as a concept. It can mean different things to different people. But often in research and teaching, we use this as an all-encompassing label that can simply mean everything and nothing. But what is it that we're really talking about? And I think it's important that we offer a critical perspective in understanding, or perhaps even moving beyond, what we mean by culture. The third aspect relates to the typical ignoring of context and interlocutors in intercultural communication, education, in the belief that individual discourses are discourses of truth, and this remains a problem. And this is something, if you think about research, we are very, very quick to say, migrant background research participants said this, or our particular language learners said this, and we take that in the way that we conceptualize research almost as a universal and objective truth in standing up for something or sharing something or highlighting something, when perhaps also we need to contest critically what people say and understand it within context and understand it within language use, much more broadly speaking. It isn't just simply that somebody says something and we should accept it. I think our role as teachers and educators and as researchers should be certainly to critically examine these aspects. It seems to be accepted, therefore, that many voices included within identity and culture are constructs that involve speaking to interlocutors in specific macro and micro contexts. Then this should be increasingly problematized in the way we think about intercultural competences. There is thus a need to move beyond what we might call mere ventriloquation in appropriating others' words for one use and the purpose of how interculturality is described and constructed. So in the sense, as a researcher or as a teacher, that we do not appropriate, whether it's a student in our classroom, whether it's our research participants' views, that we don't appropriate them to how we see the world and how we think about values and principles that are important in the world, that we give genuine senses of agency and power to our research participants, to our students, and that we're actually constructing dialogues about these issues too, which may mean that we have to step off the pedestal of knowing everything as a teacher or researcher and actually try to interrogate and in a way critically examine our own positions, so we do not appropriate others' words and impose our positions onto others. So when we think about these different components then, the following table here can sort of, and the navigation of the arrows you will see, can sort of almost conceptualize the different positions within research and teaching about intercultural competences and within broader knowledge around the field of intercultural communication. So on the left here, we have what we might call very normative, static notions of intercultural competences, of intercultural communication. And these would be characterized by what we might call Eurocentric culturalist differentialist perspectives. So they emphasize on national culture, the emphasis on national or cultural differences, the creation of borders between us and them, knowledge is somewhat objectivized, and there is a lack of concern for researchers and educators' reflexivity. And when I say this is all part of what we might call a Western-centric perspective, well, the voices, when you look at the literature, when it's usually people, you know, from a European perspective or from a US or UK perspective, you know, in very privileged universities talking about these things, do they talk about these things in relation to how other parts of the world think about and use and work on these practices? Maybe not. So we have to think about the sort of power imbalances. But also, when we dig into what we call Western-centric perspectives, it also means digging into the philosophies of how these, you know, approaches and theories were developed, mainly through, you know, the conceptualization of the European nation state, of the European project of enlightenment and modernity, and how it sees the rational subject, and how obviously the other in this sense is always irrational. It has problems with their identities, is something that is a problem for our communities, in our societies, and so on and so forth. So it's understanding that we need to be critical about these things. On the other hand, therefore, on the right, you will see the renewed intercultural perspective. So what we've seen in research in the past 10 years or so, certainly with the development of non-essentialist perspectives in interculturality and the need to equate some of these discussions to questions that pertain equality and social justice in society, then people have started to think about this perhaps more complexly and understanding the different nuances that construct intercultural competences. So intersectionality as a way of complexifying analyses of intercultural situations. It isn't just about culture. There might be a huge myriad of factors and influences that shape particular interaction, working between differences and similarities. Imagine borders that emphasize differences are questions. So it isn't just about the borders of or geography of a nation state. It isn't about the borders of how language is used. It's how perhaps people transcend borders, how borders shift and change, how maybe we think about borders as imaginaries that can mean certain things, but at the same time might be very unstable. So it's understanding that we ourselves as human beings often construct these different boundaries and understanding the tensions between and within them. Knowledge is co-constructed by persons and truth is an unstable reality. So it isn't necessarily just saying something that person A says this, person B says that, but it's understanding how, in a sense, we negotiate and co-construct these ideas constantly all the time with each other. And especially here, the word co-construction certainly relates to the co-competencies that I will talk about later. Reflexivity and criticality are central in the sense that I need to be critical and reflective of myself in the world, that I don't impose my prejudices or my biases onto others in the world in interaction. And in the sense of epistemological justice, inclusion of the other's knowledge about interculturality, which means digging into multilingual repertoires in different languages and how other people talk and how they perform and use these issues, not just from a simply Anglophone or Eurocentric perspective. So what are some of these examples? Well, some of you maybe have come into contact with, for example, Michael Byram's work, which, of course, from a critical intercultural perspective, I'm very critical of. But here you can see some of the hallmarks of his work. And I'm not going to go through all of them, but just to pick out a couple of them for you to think about. If you think about, on the left-hand side, interpreting and relating skills, relate interpretations to one's own culture and experience. Now, this can be deeply problematic in the sense that if I am constantly relating other people's interpretations of how they see things to what I see or how I see my own culture, you've almost got this constant binary juxtaposition between self and other, between this continual process that I am comparing myself. When in fact, research has shown that when we think about culture and identity and all these other aspects, we often do this through a negotiation with others, where we may construct the meanings in different languages. We may try to understand the essence of what we're talking about, and that therefore involves self and other together. It isn't really a juxtaposition. So in that sense, we have to be critical of some of these processes. The other thing here at the bottom of the screen, where it says attitudes, and the readiness to suspend disbelief about other cultures and the readiness to suspend disbelief about one's own cultures. I mean, again, these, how can you really suspend belief about these things? I always say to my students, because I'm also the program director here in Edinburgh for the MSc Language and Intercultural Communication. And I always say to my students, when we think about this word culture, we never come to culture from a value neutral perspective. We always come to the word culture by knowing something about it, whether it's through our parents, whether it's through our family, whether it's through education systems or society. Culture is never, you know, if you ask somebody on the street, what does culture mean to you? They very rarely say nothing. They'll often say something. So in that sense, then, we have to think about how we are trained to think about these issues. Some of you maybe have also come into contact with the work of Dalla Diadorf, a US scholar who has very much been influential on the work that I'll talk to you about today on the OECD, where she has this model around knowledge, skills, and attitudes. And again, there are some issues that we need to think about here. For example, in skills, viewing situations from others' perspectives, how can we really put ourselves into the mind, into the shoes of the other? How do we really know what the other is thinking? How do we really know how they are responding or how they will think or demand that we react to a situation? And if we're just viewing their situation, viewing is quite a passive word, because we're viewing this interaction. We're not necessarily, you know, critiquing it or analyzing it or summarizing it. We're just viewing it. So if it's just about viewing others, then in a sense, this is quite a self-centric perspective, because it assumes that I go back to my position of self despite the fact that I am viewing others' perspectives. Also, you can look here at attitudes at the bottom of screen. Valuing other cultures. Again, we have to understand that although there might be some positive connotations of respect, but respect is quite a deeply problematic notion, in the sense that respect, well, who is respecting what? Why do we need to respect each other? Do we negotiate these spaces and places for respect, or is it actually a way to just sanitize particular discourses and speech? And I think there's a real need to think about what respect means in our societies and how we think about that in relation to competencies, because respect will be almost simultaneously on every single competence model that you will encounter. But what does it really mean? And when you start to dig into it, what it means is actually you appreciate difference. Now, we can appreciate difference in the sense that individually we might all be different, we might all think differently and behave differently and be different human beings. But again, if we're only viewing this through a differentialist perspective or a differentialist bias, then difference is all we will see. Again, we will use culture and we will use people's identities to say, well, I'm sorry, I don't understand you because you think differently in your culture, or you think differently or understand something differently in your language. And I think that is deeply problematic, because we're still based upon this difference, this space of difference, this power relation difference between self and other. Some of you also may know in 2018, the Council of Europe published 3 volumes on the reference framework of competencies for democratic culture. And this is very much as a response to the refugee migration crisis 2015, 2016 across Europe. And you will see how in these quite large volumes, there are different descriptors, concepts, models, and guidance for implementation. Specifically, if you have an interest in this, I would advise you to have a look at Volume 3, Guidance for Implementation, and especially how it tries to guide teachers to be trained against or to notice radical extremism and terrorism in educational contexts. And when you start to unpack this particular document, you find out that actually the other really is somebody, and very clearly stated as somebody who maybe is a refugee, who maybe is a migrant, who maybe is new to Europe, who maybe is Islamic in a sense. And this is something problematic in the way the document constructs these discourses and representations. So are these models different or are they all the same? Well, you will come into contact with global competence, democratic competences, intercultural dialogue, intercultural competences, intercultural communicative competences, and the list is endless. There are similar trends and themes that I'm sure you will highlight and know, but also some of them are different. So why is this important in education today? Well, in 2018, the OECD Programme for International Student Assessment Forward states that citizens need to develop the capacity to analyse and understand global and intercultural issues. And this publication for the OECD PISA was Preparing Our Youth for an Inclusive and Sustainable World, the OECD PISA Global Competence Framework. From the foreword of the OECD 2018, which is interesting in understanding the conceptual background of how this framework is being developed, it relates to Goal 4 of the UN Sustainable Development Goals, which commits to quality of education for all. It is intentionally not limited to the foundational knowledge and skills, such as literacy, maths, and science, but places a strong emphasis on learning to live together sustainably. But such goals are only meaningful if they become visible. This has inspired the OECD Programme for International Student Assessment, the global yardstick for educational success, to include global competence in its metrics for quality, equity, and effectiveness in education. PISA will assess global competence for the first time ever in 2018. In that regard, this framework provides its conceptual underpinning. And the one thing that I ask you to do when you approach these different policies or frameworks from supranational organizations like the OECD, like the Council of Europe, we have to understand the role and purpose of the actors involved in constructing these documents, the role and purpose of the organization. Remember, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development is what OECD stands for. And this is an important factor in the type and the way they are positioning their model on global competence. So here on screen are the dimensions of global competence. So we're around the outside, we have knowledge, values, attitudes, and skills. And then within that, we have understand and appreciate the perspectives and worldviews of others, engage in open, appropriate, and effective interaction across cultures, take action for collective well-being and sustainable development, and examine local, global, and intercultural issues. So on the whole, maybe there's some things there that we can agree with. Maybe there's some things there, like the other models, maybe we can disagree with. I think it's important that we are skeptical towards these models and that we remain open to critically examining them, not just taking them as lip service, but actually thinking about their implications. So again, just to pick out a couple of examples, to understand and appreciate. Again, we can say that these words are quite passive. If we're just understanding and appreciating the worldviews of others, that isn't really a dialogue. It isn't really, for me anyway, if you think about appreciating, actually that might be contradictory to understanding. Because if we're just appreciating, it's just almost, you know, face value, tokenistic. I appreciate you've got different perspectives, but you have different perspectives, I have different perspectives, and that's fine. Again, interactions across cultures. So there's an assumption that culture is static and it's something that you move across in interaction. When you meet somebody, for example, from a different background, from a different nationality, in a different language. So again, culture is understood perhaps normatively and statically. Interestingly as well, almost they decompartmentalize local, global, and intercultural issues. So they're almost separated out, rather than seeing how the local, the global, and the intercultural are all connected together. For them, local, global, and intercultural is somewhat separate, which is interesting, I suppose. So when we get into the PISA cognitive test for global understanding, again, there are some question marks here. So on the left of screen, you'll see knowledge, knowledge of global issues, knowledge of intercultural knowledge. In the center of screen, you will see cognitive skills and processes. Let's have a look at them. So evaluate information, formulate arguments, and explain complex situations or problems. Okay. Identify and analyze multiple perspectives. Okay. Understand differences in communication. Okay. Evaluate actions and consequences. So what a word that keeps reappearing here is evaluate. But often in intercultural communication, in intercultural situations, we're not able to evaluate in that specific instance what is happening. For example, if somebody racially abuses you on the street, and you might deem that to be an intercultural encounter with someone from a different background, it might not be to a considerable amount of time after that event, then you start to understand the complexity of the issues around that why that person racially abused you. It's almost like we are taking a superficial appearance that we can just evaluate these information and arguments and then come to some understanding. And maybe there might be some understanding, but it might not reveal all understanding. Again, differences in communication are emphasized in the sense that we might speak different languages, therefore there might be conflicts, there might be miscommunication, might be misunderstandings. But I always say to my students, how frequently, even within our own languages, within our own towns and cities, within our own countries, within our own families, do we encounter communication difficulties with parents, with family members, with friends? And it's almost, again, that we're using culture and language as a problem or as an excuse here. And again, evaluating actions and consequences, we might not know. Or if you think about this cognitive test for students, students might not know the specific consequence of a specific action. Or is it that we're actually training students to do certain things and think about consequences of that, and we're giving them a prescriptive formula to follow? Perhaps that is actually the purpose of this global test. It isn't necessarily about global understanding, but it is about giving students some sort of prescriptive information. When we delve into this a little bit more, how do we assess global competence on page 6 of the OECD framework? In yellow, I've highlighted perhaps the problematic words here. And then in red, I've elaborated on some implications, not all, but some implications. So to take some of these examples, to what degree are students able to critically examine contemporary issues of local, global, and intercultural significance? So again, local, global, intercultural are viewed as being separate rather than seeing how the global world interacts and mixes constantly with the local. To what degree are students able to understand and appreciate multiple cultural perspectives and manage differences and conflicts? So this is about the self needing to understand and appreciate the other. I would argue this is sort of a passive interculturality, because it assumes that conflicts will always happen. Well, maybe conflicts won't happen. If people assume that conflicts will happen, then they'll be trying to manage conflicts all of the time. And therefore, the very discourses that they're talking with people about will be very sanitized, in a sense. Again, cultural differences are assumed. To what degree do students care about the world and take action to make a positive difference in other people's lives? I found this bizarre. The self, therefore, should be making a positive difference to the other. But what about the one's own context? What about the self's context? This is about doing positive things for others, but what about positive things for our context? Inequalities exist in access to education for global competence between and within countries. And of course, because what we know about Global PISA is that this will be part of an assessment of organizing league tables of the countries that do really well for global competencies and the countries that don't do very well for global competencies. And we can all imagine the good and the bad countries that go along with that, because they fit certain socio-political and economic ideologies. The final word I want to pick up on here is how teachers have been prepared to develop students' global competence. But why not teachers and students? Teachers are actors in classrooms, in higher education, institutions. Why is this specifically just about students' competences? What about teachers and other people's competences, the other actors in education too? There are some more examples from the Asia Society OECD 2018, which is a separate document. And I found this completely contradictory between the yellow and the blue. On the one hand, to foster global competence, teachers need to create a classroom culture in which students need to feel safe to express their opinions, safe to speculate, safe to disagree with their students and with their teacher. However, this must be without hesitation and without hurting anybody. Teachers are learning to be learners just like their students. Then on the next page, the classroom culture should also signal the values that are consistent with global competence. Teachers should help students establish norms and routines that stress the importance of respect for one another, but also should model that in their interactions with students. So hang on a minute. How can you create a culture in which people can express different opinions and feel safe to speculate, but you're saying the values of that culture should be consistent with global competence? Surely there's a contradiction there between actually you're not letting the students negotiate and construct the values and principles that they think are important in their classroom, because instead you're imposing them as normative routines onto their education, onto their learning. So how can you, on the one hand, you can have a culture, a classroom culture that is safe to speculate and safe to disagree, but you're saying, on the other hand, these values have to be consistent. So really, actually, this isn't about creating a safe space to speculate and to disagree. It's actually just about reinforcing normative values and principles on students. So to summarize, the problems and criticisms of some of these models. First, it is important to note that interculturality appears, as I've said previously, a bit of a mismatch of a concept used by different policymakers, business persons, educators, and scholars alike. The second notion is a victim of these Western centricisms, abuses of the word culture, abuses of the word identity, and also very politicized discourses and practices about, for example, non-essentialism and non-culturalism. The notion recycles concepts and notions without caring too much about their potential multilingual connotations. And I think this is ridiculous, to be honest with you, that you have a framework in English by the OECD. And if you look at all the different members of the OECD countries, I think there's about 150, 160, they will all interpret these words differently, or these concepts and values differently in their own languages, in their own local context. But yet every single time they have to understand or use what the English equivalent is. And there might be, you know, there might be lots of different meanings within that particular language about, you know, about tolerance, respect, democracy, and so on, about how you create global competences. But why is it we are only use this in English? And there are problems in using these words in English, because maybe in these local languages, the words have completely different connotations. Neither does it take into account the social lives of concepts in our global worlds. The globality of our world is so important, in the sense that it's global and local at the same time. These issues are too simplistically demarcated in the OECD document, because they're separated all the time. Fourth, interculturality seems to overemphasize nation states. And again, it's using this idea of cultural differences or conflicts in communication, that there's a conflict between East and West and so on and so forth. Fifth, differentialism and comparativism are neither neutral nor disinterested and still dominate research and these policy models. When remembering that the OECD documents and frameworks will be used as part of comparison league tables in assessment as PISA, as we all know that PISA has ranking for education for in terms of maths, science, and reading. And this will be the same for global competency. So you end up with a league table of the best countries and the worst countries. Most perspectives still are very rationalist in the way they attempt to uncover truth about what people do when they meet across cultures And therefore, we're in this sort of almost reciprocal problem that when we use culture in this way, culture is all we will see, and culture becomes a very problematic analytical category. So for my argument is, this reproduces deferentialist bias, more assumed differences between cultures and or countries and or contexts are engendered instead of similarities, thus potentially exacerbating more ignorance, more bias, more discrimination about other cultures, about other contexts. And it also can reproduce othering, whereby discourses and symbols, and especially when you think about this will be used in higher education league tables, discourses and symbols hierarchically position cultural essentialisms to often marginalize and discriminate against the other. At this point, I would say quickly, there are some considerations for teachers that we need to take into consideration. There is a lack of systemic teacher education and training around the world, which means most teachers have to improvise their teaching by relying on textbooks or materials they collect and combine, or from sources that can pass as incompatible ideologically. Studies on how intercultural competences are perceived by users, teachers, but also students, is rather scarce. And internationally, the majority of studies place particular emphasis on assessing teachers' knowledge, skills, and attitudes. Most language teachers still have a positive attitude towards integrating culture into their language classroom, but still consider culture teaching as peripheral to the commonly accepted linguistic goals of foreign language education. They also tend to deliver some sort of factual knowledge, which passes as ideologies about a particular L2 culture in a teacher-centered approach, to, and pay limited attention to develop intercultural awareness. So can we move beyond these centricisms, of Western centricisms, of self-centricisms? For me, these OECD documents and frameworks are very much about a self-centricism. As long as I know to myself that I am doing X, Y, and Z, then I know that I can be satisfied in that. But what we don't consider is how X, Y, and Z affect the other, and how the other shapes and affects us continuously in our understanding and in our practices. So a critical intercultural perspective requires questioning the terms, concepts, and notions that we use to discuss the topics, moving away from centricisms around biased and limiting or limited discourses, leading to a belief that we are more civilized, more democratic, or even better than the other. And when you think about the OECD PISA, often it is about being better, because the higher you are up the table, the better your education system is perceived. Intercultural teaching and research should not be about labeling what culture or the intercultural is, but it is about researchers, teachers, educators being reflective of their own stances, positions, and discourses. Discourse tools and methods can prevent these dichotomies of what is your culture, what is my culture, who are you, who am I, by recognizing relationships between self and other, self hyphen other, not just myself working on me. My argument, this is a question of ontology. So it's about being, it's about how we become and understand our environment in the world, how we think about our context, and this dialogue with others in context does not stop. Of course, it's about also broadening the perspectives we view these phenomena from. It isn't just about culture and where people come from. There may be other dimensions, such as gender, ethnicity, race, class, status, language, sexuality, and so on. And intersectionality, therefore, has a role in thinking about how we complexify identity, but also how we can use this to connect to the structures of inequality and to promote social justice and social change. The aim must be to put aside established descriptions and seek a broader picture and look for the hidden and unexpressed. I think what you find from these models is a very surface appearance, very generalized, almost assumptive processes and theories that we need to go way beyond. So just to summarize then, and before we move to the discussion. So discussion and conclusion. towards global and sustainable intercultural co-competences. So importantly, I think in what has been very influential on my work, and I know Heidi's work and others' work, is this transition from the intercultural to interculturality, meaning that the suffix ality translates as a process and something in the making. It isn't therefore just about acquiring a skill or competence that means that you therefore can say, I am now intercultural. I am now interculturally competent. I am now globally competent. I have an assessment, or I have a test, or I have a paper that tells me, a qualification that tells me I am interculturally competent. Actually, we would completely reject all of that because it's a process in the making. It is never finalized. It is never at an end point. It's always becoming something other. So it isn't just about students saying, yes, now I've got intercultural competence. Well, maybe at this stage of your life, maybe you think you did. Well, then maybe a few years later, maybe you think you didn't. And it's about thinking about these things in relation to the whole process of one's life. Learning with each other rather than from each other. And I think this is really important for teachers, teacher trainers, educators, us as higher education professionals, be aware of these imaginaries in education and understanding that counter-narratives do exist, that we step off the pedestal, that we think we know everything about global and intercultural competence, and that we actually actively engage in dialogues, in critiquing ourselves in the process, along with our students. So engaging and negotiating, co-constructing with our students. The first step then, I think, what we need to do about global and intercultural competence is through these words around a deep and serious intellectual and emotional catharsis. The word catharsis from Greek refers to an emotional discharge through which one can achieve a state of renewal. The second step can consist in making peace with discomfort, in becoming a disturber of peace about many ready-made ideas, discourses, words, and phrases that are imposed onto scholars and practitioners about intercultural competence that many people do not dare to question or disuse. We should be questioning these things in our education systems. It's not that we just should agree to everything the politicians and policymakers should say to us. We have to be open and critical about this. One cannot meet the other without the other meeting them. What the other does reflects what the other does with them. What one says depends on what the other says and vice versa. There's a hyphen between self and other, which we must all pay attention to. We thus agree in shifting intercultural competences from the position of I or self-centricism towards co-competences based upon an ontology of the self-other while going through the steps of catharsis. So we need to know when to stop, know to when to reject, know to when to reflect, know to when to think, okay, how do I use this in my context? How am I going to develop this with my students? Do I give my students agency and voice to be able to develop their own thinking and ideas on these things? Or am I just simply rehearsing and regurgitating what I want them to say? I think also, and just a few slides left, there is a need for ethics in all of this, in thinking about our ethical relationships to each other in the global world. And I think especially over the times of the pandemic, this has become more and more visible and much and more needed in how we think about our future. So in shifting intercultural competences from self-centricism towards co-competences, it is important for teachers, teacher educators, students, but also researchers to be equipped to analyze multiple voices in order to unearth imposed ideologies. In my own work, based upon the philosophies of Mikhail Bakhtin, Bakhtin refers to what he calls the crisis of outsideness, which means that the self and other can never be in a stable evaluative position, that I can never know what, as an other, what you demand of me, what you are thinking. Maybe you're thinking all of this lecture is absolute nonsense and rubbish. Maybe you think I'm talking too much and I need to stop. But the point is, in intercultural global encounters, whatever you want to call them, we never know what the other is demanding of us. We never know what they're thinking. We never know how they are reflecting, what they demand us to do as an action. So therefore, we have to engage in a sort of reciprocal ethics between each other so that I don't impose or violate myself onto you, and so you don't impose or violate yourself onto me. So there's this reciprocal ethics that is very necessary in how we think about these issues. So it's about understanding that the concepts, therefore, are non-normative. It means that for educators and scholars, refraining from as much as possible from opposing values onto others involved in intercultural encounters, that there may be different meanings or different ideologies or different ways of thinking about this notion or concept, and that's fine. There isn't just one universal way. Instead, intercultural competencies is understood as a dynamic process relying on the actioning of co-competencies. So co-actioning, co-learning, co-experiencing, co-being, because we never experience all of these things in our lives in a vacuum. We do it through interactions with others every single day of our lives and in everyday interaction. It isn't just that we just live and exist on our own. We do this constantly, whether it's online, physically, virtually, whether it's in different spaces and places with different people. We do it all the time in our lives. It isn't just therefore that you acquire a self-centric perspective on these ideas. You do this through engaging with others, whether it's through literature, whether it's through academic work, whether it's through listening to your lecturers, whatever. A dialogic approach for IC then involves digging into these voices and understanding that there's a real sense of ideologies behind these concepts, and we need to escape them and to see how they function and how they're affecting our practice. Why is this important in global education? While teaching and researching, we've often felt that many scholars or teachers of IC fall into the trap of using and reproducing, again, Western models because they believe them to be the only legitimate universal ones. However, by reproducing these models without questioning the ideologies, there may be a risk of submitting to economic political agendas of which the users may not be aware. It's important for teachers and scholars to thus identify the economico-political and ethico-political ideologies and agendas behind supranational models such as the OECD in order to decide if they fit into their own context or simply if they agree with them. There's a need, therefore, to reconfigure IC to make students and teachers about the role of education in the world and about your role and how there are different ideologies and political views in the world. Knowledge about self and other is problematic, often positions them in static ways. And I think this will be one of the final takeaway points before I move to the final slide. In higher education, we need to train ourselves constantly, all of us, not just teachers, not just lecturers, not just professors, everybody, critically to accept, to revise and to reject ideologies that lie behind certain things. There may be some things that we simply have to reject, some things that we simply have to stop, some things we don't agree with, and there may be some things that we do agree with. And it's about coming together and negotiating and understanding these things. Why is this all important today and tomorrow? Of course, in the past 2 years, the times of coronavirus, we've seen increasingly xenophobic, sinophobic, racism, fear of the other, fear of the unknown. Of course, I'm not arguing that these discourses and representations have not just happened now. They've been around for a long time, but certainly the visibility and perhaps the polarity of these ideas and these issues that need to be combated in our society have become more and more visible. As teachers and researchers, we have an ethical obligation in the ways our actions, behaviors, and discourses can transmit symbolic violence, essentialisms, and stereotypes. There is thus a need to decontextualize and recontextualize intercultural competencies through a non-normative dialogical ethics. And I hope today this starts the discussion for you. And I hope this has been a useful discussion in thinking about how we move beyond certain centricisms in terms of thinking about new potentialities to explore global and sustainable intercultural competences. Thank you for your time. Thank you for giving me this opportunity. And I'm looking forward to our discussion now around the key issues.